Chapter 67. A marine seal is usually defined as an aquatic carnivorous mammal with webbed flippers and soft fur. But the wraith-like phantoms who suddenly materialized around Prevloff and the fallen guards bore little resemblance to their namesake. The United States Navy SEALs, an acronym of sea, air, and land, were members of an extraordinary elite fighting group, trained in every phase of combat from underwater demolition to jungle warfare. There were five of them, encased in pitch-black rubber wetsuits, hoods, and tight slipper-like boots. Their faces were indistinguishable under the ebony war paint, making it all but impossible to tell where the wetsuits left off and flesh began. Four men held M24 automatic rifles with collapsible stocks, while the fifth tightly gripped the Stoner weapon, a wicked-looking affair with two barrels. One of the SEALs detached himself from the rest and helped Pitt and Dana to their feet. "Oh, God," Dana moaned. "I'll be black and blue for a month." For perhaps 5 dazed seconds, he massaged her aching body, oblivious to the fact that Pitt's jacket had come open. When shocked realization did come, when she saw the guards sprawled grotesquely in death, her voice dropped to a whisper. "Oh, shit. Oh, shit." "I think it's safe to say the lady survived," Pitt said with a half-grin. He shook the SEAL's hand, then introduced him to Sandecker, who was unsteadily clutching Giardino's shoulder for support. "Admiral Sandecker, may I present our deliverer, Lieutenant Fergus, United States Navy SEALs?" Sandecker acknowledged Fergus's smart salute with a pleased nod, released his hold on Giardino, and stood ramrod straight.
"The ship, Lieutenant. Who commands the ship?"
"Unless I'm mistaken, sir, you do." Fergus's words were punctuated by another burst of echoing gunfire from somewhere in the cavernous depths of the ship. "The last stubborn holdout," Fergus smiled. It was obvious. His white teeth gleamed like a neon sign at midnight. "The ship is secure, sir. My ironclad guarantee on it."
"And the pumping crew?"
"Safe and sound and back at their work."
"How many men in your command?"
2 combat units, Admiral. 10 men in all, including myself." Sandecker's eyebrows raised.
"Only 10 men, did you say?"
"Ordinarily, for an assault of this nature," Fergus said matter-of-factly, "we'd have used just 1 combat unit. But Admiral Kemper thought it best to double our force, to be on the safe side."
"The Navy's advanced some since I served," Sandecker said wistfully.
"Any casualties?" Pitt asked.
"Until 5 minutes ago, 2 of my men wounded, nothing serious, and 1 missing.
"Where did you come from?"
The question was from Merker's lips. He was staring malevolently over the shoulder of a wary SEAL. There was no ship in the area. No aircraft was sighted. How?
Fergus looked at Pitt questioningly. Pitt nodded. "Permission granted to inform our former colleagues the fact of life, Lieutenant. He can muse over your answers while he's sitting in a cell on death row."
"We came aboard the hard way," Fergus obliged. "From 50 feet below the surface, through the torpedo tubes of a nuclear submarine. That's how I lost 1 of my men. The water was rough as hell. A wave must have crushed him against the Titanic's hull while we were taking turns climbing the boarding ladders, dropped over the side by Mr. Pitt."
"Strange that no one else saw you come on board," Spencer murmured.
"Not strange at all," Pitt said. "While I was helping Lieutenant Fergus and his team come over the aft cargo deck bulwarks, and then tucking them away in the chief steward's old cabin on sea deck, the rest of you were assembled in the gymnasium, awaiting my soul-stirring speech on personal sacrifice."
Spencer shook his head. "Talk about fooling all of the people some of the time."
"I have to hand it to you," Gunn said. "You had us all flim-flammed." At that, the Russians nearly stole the ballgame. We didn't expect them to make their play until the storm quieted down. Boarding during the lull of the hurricane's eye was a masterstroke, and it almost worked. Without either Giardino or the Admiral or me to warn the Lieutenant,
We three were the only ones privy to the SEAL's presence. Fergus would never have known when to launch his attack on the borders.
"I don't mind admitting," Sandecker said. "For a while there, I thought that we'd had it. Giardino and I, prisoners of Prevlov, and Pitt thought to be dead."
"God knows," Pitt said. "If the helicopter hadn't wedged itself into the promenade deck, I'd be asleep in the deep right now."
"As it was," Fergus said, "Mr. Pitt looked like death warmed over when he stumbled in the chief steward's cabin. A hardy man, this one. Half drowned, his head split open, and yet he still insisted on guiding my team through this floating museum until we located your Soviet visitors."
Dina was looking at Pitt in a peculiar way.
"How long were you hiding in the shadows before you made your grand entrance?"
Pitt grinned slyly. "For a minute prior to your striptease."
"You bastard! You stood there and let me make an ass out of myself," she flared. "You let them use me like I was a cut of beef in a butcher store window."
"I used you too, dear heart, as a matter of necessity. After I found Woodson's body and the smashed radio in the gymnasium, I didn't need a gypsy to tell me the boys from the Ukraine had boarded the ship. I then rounded up Fergus and his men and led them down to the boiler rooms, figuring the Russians would already be guarding the pumping crew. I was right. First priorities first. Whoever controlled the pumps controlled the derelict. When I saw that I would be more hindrance than help in overcoming the guards, I borrowed a SEAL and came looking for the rest of you. After wandering through half the ship, we finally heard voices coming out of the dining saloon. Then I ordered the SEAL to hightail it below for reinforcement.
Then it was all a great big stalling tactic," Dana said.
"Exactly. I needed every second I could beg, borrow, or steal until Fergus showed up and evened the odds. That's why I held off until the last second to put in an appearance."
"A high-stakes gamble," Sandecker said. "You cut Act Two a bit fine, didn't you?"
"I had two things going for me," Pitt explained. "One was compassion. I know you, Admiral. In spite of your gargoyle exterior, you still help little old ladies across streets and feed stray animals. You might have waited until the last instant to give in, but you would have given in." Then Pitt put his arms around Dana and slowly produced a nasty-looking weapon from a pocket of the jacket draped on his shoulders. "Number two was my insurance policy. Fergus loaned it to me before the party began. It's called a stoner weapon. It shoots a cloud of tiny, needle-like flechettes. I could have cut down Prevlov and half his men with one burst."
"And I thought you were being a gentleman," Dana said with a contrived, bitter tone. "You only hung your jacket on me so they wouldn't find the gun when they searched you."
"You have to admit that your, exposed condition made for an ideal distraction."
"Begging your pardon, sir," said Chief Bascom. "But why on earth would this rusty old bucket of bolts interest the Russians?"
"My very thoughts," Spencer added. "What's the big deal?"
"I guess it's a secret no longer,"
Pitt shrugged. "It's not the ship the Russians were after. It's a rare element called byzanium that sank with the Titanic back in 1912. Properly processed and installed in a sophisticated defense system, so I'm told, it'll make intercontinental ballistic missiles about as outdated as flying dinosaurs." Chief Bascom let out a long, low whistle.
"And you mean to say that stuff is still below deck somewhere?"
"Buried under several tons of debris, but it's still down there."
"You'll never live to see it, Pitt. None of you. None of us will. The Titanic will be totally destroyed by morning."
There was no anger in Prevlov's face, but something touching on complacent satisfaction. "Did you really think every contingency was not allowed for? Every possibility for failure not backed up by an alternate plan? If we cannot have the byzanium, then neither can you."
Pitt looked at him with what seemed to be bemusement.
"Forget any hopes you entertain of the cavalry, or, in your case, the Cossacks, galloping to the rescue, Prevlov. You made a hell of a try, but you were playing against an American idiom known as a stacked deck. You prepared for everything. Everything, that is, except a setup in preparation for a double cross. I don't know how the scheme was nurtured. It must have been a wonder of creative cunning. And you fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. I'm sorry, Captain Prevlov, but to the victor belong the spoils.
The Byzantium belongs to the Russian people, Prevlov said gravely. It was raped from our soil by your government. It is not we who are the robbers, Pitt. It is you. A moot point. If it were a work of historical art, a national treasure, my State Department would no doubt see it off on the next ship back to Murmansk, but not when it's the prime ingredient for a strategic weapon. If our roles were reversed, Prevlov, you wouldn't give it away any more than we would. Then it must be destroyed. You're wrong. A weapon that does not take lives, but simply protects them, must never be destroyed. Your kind of sanctimonious philosophy simply affirms what our leaders have known all along. You cannot win against us. Someday, in the not-too-distant future, your precious experiment in democracy will go the way of the Greek Senate. A piece of an era for students of communism to study, nothing more. Don't hold your breath, comrade. Your kind will have to show a lot more finesse before you can run the world. Read your history, Prevlov said with an ominous smile. The people whom the sophisticated nations down through the centuries have referred to as the barbarians have always won in the end. Pitt smiled back courteously as the SEALs herded Prevlov, Merker, and Drummer up the grand staircase to a stateroom where they would be secured under heavy guard. But Pitt's smile was not genuine. Prevlov was right. The barbarians always won in the end.